Hey everybody, this is just a little live Q&A after we recorded episode 108. Just Lee and I going back and forth in the chat a little bit. Thought I'd throw it in here as a bonus clip this week. Hope you enjoy. 3, 2, 1. Okay, I can cut it there. Now we can just go to the chat or say whatever.
Sweet. Sweet. Yeah, that was good. Yeah, okay, back to Brian Trotter. So I don't remember that name. Do you remember that name? I haven't seen that before. To you guys, thank you a ton for the knowledge. I have to thank Scott for the laughs. I was listening to the podcast with my wife when Scott mentioned his CFI had him doing loops and spins.
Oh, she said, you do loops. I said, ignore him. He's full of excrement. And the seaplane flying, yeah. I never had to deal with boat wakes.
Oh, man.
In my seaplane training.
Mm.
Because I did it out of Jack Brown's, and we're on all these small lakes where there just wasn't really boats that much. Or if there was a boat, there was a lake right on the, you just go over the next one.
No, my phone just died, so yeah, I don't have the chat anymore. Yeah, the last thing he said, so one of the things, if you were to get out to the sectional, look at the Sandusky Bay, one thing is about Lake Erie, and Rob, you can speak to this better than I could, but it's, honestly, it functions almost more like the ocean. Like, it is very prone, like, light winds kick up waves very well. It doesn't have any, what I want to say, like, inertia. Like, it kicks up waves very easily. Chop very easily. Right, Rob?
I would word it as it's like the ocean in the fact that it's open water.
Yes.
But it's very unlike the ocean with how shallow, especially the western area,
yes,
by the Lake Erie Islands.
Yes.
That's like 30, it's like 20, 35, 50-ish feet.
Yes.
Like the deepest point of Lake Erie is over on the east end towards New York State. It hits like 200 feet deep over there. But the vast majority over on the west end where we're at in the Lake Erie Islands, we always talk about flying, that's not that deep as far as a open body of water like that. Typically they're deeper open bodies of water like that.
And so that helps kick it up, right?
Yeah, that causes it can change very fast. It can kick up very fast if it, like a northeaster comes through a storm and kicks it up. It can kick up. It can go from calm to really kicked up very fast. And that shallow depth also causes issues where like an 8-foot swell in Lake Erie is a lot different than an 8-foot swell on the ocean because of the frequency.
Frequency, right.
So it's like an 8-foot wave on an ocean's not that big a deal usually. It's just, you know, you run the boat over it. It's just like a, might make you seasick if there's a bunch of them and you're going out to the Bahamas and the angle you got to go to get to Nassau is not good, or Grand Bahama's not good, and, you know, make you seasick, but it's not going to like wreak havoc on the boat. Where like 8-foot waves in Lake Erie is like, and you're trying to get the Kellys, that can be really uncomfortable. Depending on the boat, it could be very dangerous. Usually there's small craft advisories and all that kind of jazz with,
yeah,
once it kicks up like that. So it's because the waves are so tight together. And then once you get over to the Sandusky Bay area, there's boat wakes added into there and there's a bunch of stuff it's hitting and it gets really sloppy. There's no rhyme or reason the direction the waves are coming from.
Yeah, you've got like secondary swell and then boat wake. I mean, it's insane.
Yep.
So like you think, like we're talking about the islands a lot, there's no seaplane operators because of all of this phenomena happening. Lake Erie is very inhospitable to seaplanes. I don't know really anything about the other Great Lakes, but this one is, even though we have, honestly, if the lake were just a little bit different, it would be, different in either way, calmer or whatever, deeper, I don't know, maybe oriented a little bit differently, like the directional, it'd be, oh my God, it'd be amazing for seaplanes, probably, but it's not what we have. So everything has, all these islands we talk about, they all have airports, because in the winter, in the summer, it's definitely not the lifeblood, because they all have ferry service. And then obviously a lot of people, the residents have their own boats, but it's not hospitable to seaplanes at all. I learned that I landed back in the Sandusky Bay one time in a 206 on amphibs. I was like, holy shit, what the hell? How am I going to get out of here? And I just, kind of taxing in circles for a minute, like, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes probably. Well, it felt maybe not that long, maybe five, but it felt like 10 or 15. So maybe it was, but till you kind of just let the boat wake around you, because everybody's interested, because there's not that many seaplanes around, like none.
Yeah.
So everybody's interested. The jet skiers are out, you know, messing around and like kind of being a nuisance. You just kind of got to let people, let things kind of calm down. I mean, it wasn't a rough day per se, but all the boat traffic right there and people being interested made it. I had to let that subside, let them get bored basically, and then took back off. And it got upset pretty good. And it took me a long time because I would hit, you know, I'd hit the front of an oncoming, you know, not swell, but wake or you know, a wave of some sort, and would knock back your airspeed again. And it's like, Jesus Christ, just beating the shit out of the airplane. And eventually got off. But yeah, it's that's always an interesting aspect to seaplane flying, because I'm not a boater. So
yeah, general rule of thumb, if it's a boat like less than 50 feet, really less than 40 feet, it's a 90% chance that the people running it have no clue what they're doing. Just are completely oblivious to the fact that there is actually a thought process and a strategy to actually navigate waterways and stuff. It just, by salesman sells on the boat, they hop on it and they just clueless. It's worse down here in Florida, but it happens up there as well. And I'm curious too, my main point is, if you have way more seaplane time than I have, but I have way more boating time than you have. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you were a boat, if you had the boating time that I had, I have to feel as though you'd have a way more of a comfort level with the reading the waves, or if there's a boat wake, knowing how that boat wake is going to affect the float, and like how to land and know, you know, to stay out of the way of that boat wake.
Yeah.
Like stuff I take for granted just because I was, my dad taught me how to run them when I was so young. I don't even remember learning how to run a boat. Well, you're more of like that on the aviation side. You kind of were around it when you're so young. You probably have a lot of memories and stuff that's just second nature to you with the flying side that I had to learn because I didn't start till I was really a teenager. But yeah, I'm just curious if you.
It'd be interesting. You know, maybe one day we can try it.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like I'd have a lot higher comfort level after I get some seaplane hours dealing with some stuff just because I'm so comfortable on the water.
Yeah. No, definitely. Yeah. There's no question. No question about that.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Oh,
I got nothing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Spencer says, yeah, Rob, Spencer, have you heard of Tropic Ocean Airways? They hire first officers at 250 hours if you have a seaplane rating. That's what they claim on their website. How long did I try to get in with Tropic Ocean Airways? It was like a year.
Was it a year? Oh, I didn't know that.
I don't know if it was a full year. I spent, it had to have been over a year.
College try year, I would say.
Six months.
That's what I was going to say. 6 months.
Well, I'm saying I didn't have a job for 6 months. So like it was a part-time job of mine to try to get a job at Tropic Ocean Airways. And I couldn't even get an interview. So, and I met all their qualifications. What was it? I went to the Miami Seaplane Base. It seems harder to get into to just go hang out at now, the last time I drove by it. But this was in 2018, I think. So I was down in Miami. So I went to the seaplane base and I just like hung out there for the day because I knew Tropic Ocean comes into that seaplane base. They're such a cool base down there. The city of Miami owns it now, so they'll probably ruin it. But
probably.
It was... So I was hanging out there and I kept trying to remember his name. They taxied. I got videos on my phone and everything. And what is his name? I can't remember. I met one of their pilots. And this was back when I was on Instagram before Zuckerberg threw me off. So I was friends with him on Instagram and I was he was giving me kind of advice on how to get in. And I how to do the applications. I did multiple applications. I went through their online process, which you I think you have to do now. But when I first started doing it, it was like a they had a paper application too. So I was like physically be dropping those off. I think I might have given the guy I kind of knew from meeting him at the seaplane base. I can't remember.
Like let him walk it in or no?
Yeah, okay. Walk in like an actual hand copy. I don't know if I did that or not.
The thing is, though, those are different types of jobs. We can talk about it.
Yeah. It's driving me nuts now. I can't remember this guy's name. Cool dude.
I'm sure. I'm sure their culture is a very specific type of culture. It's not so, you're not so much there probably for pay as you are for the culture, the quality of life. You live in base, you're home every night, you don't get paid anything, but you're getting multi-engine or you're getting seaplane turbine time.
Yeah. James Maddox? Maybe? I feel like his last name was Maddox.
The problem is, though, is the thing, like, this can happen. What's maybe more pertinent is these things happen. You can run into, you know, a line pilot for United, FedEx, American, and you can, you know, they like you and, you know, you're, you know, their son's best friend, whatever the case may be, and girl, son's girlfriend, whatever. And they can take your resume and they can walk in it for you. But the chief pilot, the talent acquisition, they get a pile of 5,000 resumes already. They need to, like, how do they get you from the big pile to the small pile? If you're no college, this is like me, I'm describing me, no college degree. I meet all the other requirements, but I'm no college degree, no military. I don't do any like Habitats for Humanity or any of that stuff. They want all of that. They need you to be like a good citizen. You know what I mean? Like they need you to be a good citizen, military background, with a college degree or a master's.
I do think the military background helps.
Oh, it 100% helps.
At that, the owner, Rob, is ex naval pilot, I think.
It 100% helps. Like there's a point system for like a lot of the majors. And that's one of those things. So if you know, like me, I know a lot of people in the airlines, been around aviation my whole life. And a lot of them have gone on, you know, came through the company that my like family owns, and they've gone on to go to the airlines. They were like a feeder for airlines and they've gone through the motions. They're all at all the airlines you can think of. There was probably a pilot that's worked there that's at one. And that has not landed me anything because, again, I'm just a resume. You know, I have good flight time and whatever. And I would meet all those flight time requirements. But with no military and no, like, extracurricular activities that set me apart and no college degree, I'm just in the blah pile. That's just what it is. So when that recruiter or that talent acquisition person gets your resume in their hand, it's kind of like, okay, Joe, you walked this in, but what makes you think that I should put this resume ahead of the 5,000 resumes in this pile? Can you tell me what that reason is? Because if you don't have one that's valid or that I won't find on this resume when I read it, then it doesn't matter. It's going to stay in that pile. It doesn't matter who walks it in.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, look where I am. You know, I mean, I haven't tried that hard, but I don't think that it's...
Yeah, I ran into one of their marketing guys. I do remember this guy's name, Kermit Crew, who's also got along with Will. He tried to get me some leeway. Mm-hmm. As far as getting my application looked at. So now I had Josh Maddox, supposedly. I didn't know Josh that well.
James,
I met him once. Ago. James?
Is it James or Josh? Must be Josh, because that came out really smooth right
there. Yeah, I think it's Josh Maddox.
Yeah, okay, must be.
I met him initially, not the Miami Seaplane Base. And then I just randomly threw yachting. Kermit Crew was trying to... he was just handing out flyers at the yachts. at the marina I was at. And then, so I saw the Tropic Ocean Airways shirt and I'm like, hey, and I actually helped him figure out a better way to do what he was doing based on my knowledge of the super yachting world. And so he was, of course, I don't think it helped that much, but he was happy that I was trying to help him with, you know, gave him some knowledge of how super yachting works. And so, yeah, he was trying to help me out then. And then there was also Stefano,
he was the DPE guy?
No. I was working on a double eye with him for a little bit. He was retired Italian airline pilot.
Yeah, so I said now, DPE. Oh, he's just an instructor.
He's a double eye. Yeah, he was a double eye I was working with. He had heard through our conversations of doing some double eye training together that I was interested in getting a job at Tropic Ocean Airways. And one of his former students was flying for him. So he even put it in and said, hey, this guy, Rob, can fly. Like, I'm instructing him right now on double eye stuff. And like, I've flown with him in the plane. We're doing a lot of sim stuff, but I flew with him in the plane too. And he was even like vouching for me, like, hey, this guy, like, is a good pilot. So that was like three potential ins with people at the company. Nothing.
They got a stack of people who will work for less than you will, probably. And I mean, I'm sure they have, but
we never even got to that conversation, like about the price.
All right. Well, I'm just saying they have a stack of applications already for people that are, you know, into their second career, have made their money. It's just one of those things. It's just a different type of gig where it's not so money motivated, and they get a different stack of resumes, and they're looking for something else.
Yeah. Crazy. Okay. We spent a lot of time on that.
Those concepts though still apply though with the majors though, or airlines. Just throwing that out there, guys.
Question for Lee, since you can't read the chat. Did flying the river visual into DCA ever make you nervous just being around all the restricted airspace?
Yeah, honestly, early on, yeah, because you're putting the pressure on yourself, of course, to adhere and fly exactly the profile, you know, and at first when you didn't know what you're doing, when I was first based there, you know, it was like, man, am I doing this right? I mean, nobody said anything yet, so I hope I am. And then over time, as you get more and more comfortable, hey, they didn't yell at me this time. They didn't yell at me this time. Eventually, you're kind of freed up to start really dialing it in, being on airspeed, and you're kind of your descent profile and stuff like that. It did make me nervous at the beginning, for sure. You know, when I was an FO, first few times I went in there, I was hanging on to the tail. I was just like, okay, just tell me when to talk. Just tell me when to do something, you know, because you're like, you know, you're looking at the plate and they're like doing the whole thing. The captain's doing the whole thing. But then when you're in the left seat, shoes on the other foot. And yeah, it was still a whole different level of nervousness because you had seen it done a lot and you'd kind of been present for it, you know, and now you're doing it yourself, or you're watching somebody else do it and make sure they don't get in trouble. It made me nervous at the beginning, but then you get it dialed in. I didn't care. I didn't let like P-56 and stuff, the White House and stuff, freak me out any more than just my desire to adhere to like the published visual approach procedure. I wanted to adhere to that so closely. The P-56, the prohibited areas, were almost like just a second thought. They would have just been collateral damage, I guess, if I would have messed up. I wanted to adhere to the profile almost exactly, as best as I could. And I guess I always biased a little bit, you know, to the other side of the river, but yeah, I didn't let the P-56 area freak me out. Who's saying this? Are they going to be based there or what?
This was Spencer.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. That's always, I read you the whole thing.
Okay. Yep. Just fly the procedure. Do your best and chance, you know, obviously bias to the other side of the river, you know, and it won't be as big a factor.
As a student with 55 hours, this is Brian. As a student with 55 hours, my old CFI had me doing everything using paper maps, nav logs, sectionals, and E6B to prepare for practical. It takes two times long to do anything and adds a lot of saturation. I transitioned to a new CFI who told me to start using ForeFlight. What are your thoughts about using it in training?
I have layered thoughts about this. I think it's important to know the fundamentals. I am a purist, so I really think it's important to know the fundamentals, not just from a surface level, but I also, what do you think I use now? You know, I'm not using an E6B to go figure out anything with what I'm doing for my day job. It's ForeFlight and flightplan.com. Now, granted, I have a lot of experience to draw from, rules of thumb that I use routinely. Once I get in the airplane, I have a highly capable airplane that if I miss something in a NOTAM or weather or something like that, if I miss it, I have a highly capable airplane that I have a multiplicity of outs, if you will. And I have a lot of time, I have a lot of experience, and my airplane is very capable. So I have all those things in my corner so that my planning can be a little bit more lax than a low time pilot with a not very capable airplane. So it's tough. I think you need to know the roots of stuff, but I also understand if you're just going to try and go out and fly in flight plan, like, at a glance, ForeFlight is hard to beat. 100%. I think you need to know both. I think as time goes on, maybe you would appreciate the when all the batteries die or when things just don't work. I think you would appreciate knowing the grassroots stuff. But I understand the practical nature of putting in your points in ForeFlight and just walking out the door. Totally get it.
Yeah. We'll do like one more something here, and then we'll wrap it up. I want to get done by 10 here. I got to wake up early in the morning. I got to pull a Scott only like 2 hours later than he would. Brunk Horse just vomited all over the chat. I'm trying to make sense of it, any of it. I'll start reading. The example I posted on Pilot Ground, landing the Beaver in Lake Union, was obscene amount of traffic to... Yeah. Thread the needle through.
Yes.
Landing at a 45 degree angle to the wake mitigates both roll and pitch changes, which may introduce some crosswind challenges. I highly recommend anyone getting into C get their tailwheel first. Landing with a float side loaded will cause other problems with control as it sets down on the keel. It'll be on rails and move in the direction it's pointed, which could be very bad at higher speeds. Yes.
Don't sideload anything that's part of your anything. Yeah, sideloading is bad. Get that. That needs to be ironed out with your... I agree with everything he said. No, I can't think of anything he said ever that I don't agree with. But yeah, for sure. Tailwheel stuff will pay for itself. Transitioning to seaplane, don't side load anything. Even if it's a little bit, do better. I'm flying with guys now who still side load the gear and they don't understand. They don't even see it. They feel it like it's a firmer landing. Well, so yeah, because you're like, now maybe it sounds more dramatic than it is. I mean, it's subtle, but straight. Get that wing down, put in that opposite rudder, and so you're kind of cross-controlled for your crosswind landings. Obviously, you don't want to drop it so far you're dragging a wingtip. That's something we have to worry about because the airplane has a much higher crosswind limit than, you know, lighter airplanes. But the wing is not that much bigger, all things considered. So you're having from now you're going fast. You have aileron authority, but you get that wing damn low. You're damn low. So you're putting that aileron in to stop your drift, and you're putting that rudder in to land longitudinally straight, stop the weather vane, basically land longitudinally straight. And that's where I see a lot of the side load happen, which is similar, I think, situation to what Tyler's trying to talk about is, yeah, you're trying to mitigate any upset from wake on the water, but now you have wind playing a factor in what you're doing with the actual the landing gear, the floats, and just have that ironed out on your, even if it's a little bit, like if the instructor's not giving you any feedback and you're, it's a crosswind day, so that side load, was that, like, figure that out, have that ironed out. I don't want you coming into a jet and side loading. It's not necessary. It doesn't have to be done. You're not flying the airplane at its limit, like, almost ever. So I'm not saying everybody does this. I'm just saying I see it, and it's just like,
If you can find competent tailwheel instruction, take advantage of it as a pilot. It'll serve you very well, very, very well throughout a lot of other things in aviation.
Yes.
And seaplane is always, it should be like a bucket list item, if not more. I always encourage both the tailwheel or seaplane. If someone was just going to do one or the other, Lee, tailwheel. What would you recommend? Yeah, I probably would too, as much as I love the seaplane stuff.
100%. Tailwheel will, it's a little more accessible and probably cheaper. Accessibility, affordability, but it still has the it can save your life quotient.
Okie dokie. 5 minutes. Okay. Spencer says thank you for all of the entertainment and sometimes knowledge.
I would like Joshua, to think there's a little more knowledge.
No, days. He didn't actually. I reread his words I did with Brunkhorst earlier. Joshua says, how did you guys deal with those rare students that question your knowledge when you're 100% correct, or just students who come off as disrespectful? I'll tell you how I deal with it as a CFI, and then Lee can share his strategies. I never used my CFI. That's how I avoided it through all these years of being a CFI, is I don't use it.
Pretty foolproof strategy.
So it's a guaranteed, for the most part, not going to run into that situation. But Mr. Griffin, you said earlier you had 1,800 hours. 1,300 hours dual, yes, given. So did you run into this at all?
I did. And I don't know, as I do try to paint a picture of humility, I'm an egotistical, arrogant guy. I just am.
Yes.
And how much did I bring upon myself? Probably all of it. I'm a jackass. I think I know everything. I know a lot. I do know a lot. I might not know, if you give me a 10 on a subject, a 10 out of 10 quiz, I probably won't get 10 out of 10. I might get 8 out of 10. I know kind of a lot about a lot of this stuff. I might not be able to get that through on the podcast or whatever on Pilot Ground. Might not be able to get all that through, but I am pretty knowledgeable on a lot of the stuff. But that being said, you all know, you guys have a pretty good glimpse into my personality. I'm pretty egotistical and arrogant. I try to work on it. I really do. But it's probably brought a lot of the problems on myself. And with aviation, people learning to fly, it's like being a golf pro at your local, golf course or whatever. Let's say you're on the high school golf team and you're doing lessons on the weekends with successful business people. Flying to me was kind of like the equalizer. You have doctors, very successful business people. They build a company up from nothing. So you have these types of type A personalities. I'm obviously a very type A personality. That doesn't always work when you're a 20-something-year-old kid and you're trying to teach a 40, 45, 50-year-old very successful person who rolls up in his Porsche how to fly. That doesn't work, especially when you're both kind of egomaniacs and whatever. It doesn't work. So it's tough because they're always going to second guess. And there are a lot of intuitive things about aviation when you're teaching. You know, they probably have been into boating or something. And there's a lot of things you can tie into everyday concepts for correlation. There's some things that are kind of one-offs. You know, one thing that always comes to mind to me is when you're going through talking about your structural airspeeds. And kind of one of my questions is, what is the only structural airspeed that is not marked on the airspeed indicator? And it's maneuvering speed, VA. And so one of the issues with that particular speed is that it has kind of a negative, it doesn't work the way you would think it is. So kind of the way you I would work through talking about it is, does the speed go up or down when the weight goes down? And the speed, the maneuvering speed actually goes down as weight goes down, which is not super intuitive. You want to think that you have a little bit more safety margin, because the airplane doesn't weigh as much. You're not able to exert as much force on it. But that's not true. Since the airplane doesn't weigh as much, it is able to maneuver more aggressively, thus pull more G's without stalling. Because that's all it is. Maneuvering speed is just, you're going to stall the airplane before you hurt it. And so if weight goes down, stall speed goes down. So if weight goes down, maneuvering speed must also go down, is kind of the easiest way. And so you have to be kind of prepared. That's just right off the top of my head here. That is something that I kind of ran into often. People that are used to, like, oh, you know, my Porsche, when I take it to the track, you know, this just doesn't make sense. It's like, well, okay, we need to talk about it. And if they go deeper than that, I would have to like start really thinking about it. And I would not have good answers for it. And just like right now, I'm kind of out of answers how to talk about that particular thing right now. But they would leave for the day. We'd kind of let that go, leave for the day. I'd come up with like, I'd run some numbers, run some math, and be kind of prepared for that conversation the next time. But it's every person a little bit different that walks in that door that you deal with. And over time, you do come up with tips and tricks. And some things you just have to let go. Let them, okay, well, okay, I hear what you're saying. Read this chapter. We can talk more about it. Or if you have the resources, like I did, but I didn't use because I was egotistical and immature, I would not go to my dad or brother or another senior, a senior pilot that had more time than me. And maybe they could explain better than me. Maybe they couldn't. I don't know that answer. But probably more often than not, especially early on, they could. I didn't use that resource. And so it was a huge lesson, which I only learned way later in my career, just basically kind of cut the shit. You're not the best pilot there ever has been or ever will be. Act that way. And it took the airlines kind of to beat that out of me. And I had some really good role model captains that I flew with fairly frequently that taught me that. We weren't grading each other's landings. We weren't doing all these things. So the ego kind of got beat out of me. So if I had to give you some advice, the biggest thing, if you're trying to work on how you're going to, I don't want to say fix somebody else, but I need to say that in order for my little saying here to work out, you probably need to work on fixing yourself first, if that makes any sense. And the way to do that is don't have an ego about it. It's super low-hanging fruit for you to just be like, well, I'm confident in my answer. The book says that I'm right. So let's either, you can dig into this when you go home and see that I'm right, or we can dig in it together and see why I'm right here. You might not have the reasons why you're right. That's true. But if you're confident, of course, and it takes time. When I started flight instructing, I had less answers. More times than not, I didn't have the answers. I had to use the, and I'm sure your one of your instructor pilots teaching your CFI will tell you, we can look it up together. Let's look it up. I don't have the answer to that. Let's look it up. Same thing when you're taking your CFI check ride or any of your other check rides. I don't know that answer, but I can look it up. You're going to have that same answer for your students a lot. Then over a few months, over a few years, you're going to have pretty much heard it all and know what most people ask and have a lot of those things, that spiel, if you will, pretty well ironclad and be able to go in depth as far as they want to go. But yeah, it's I would say it's mostly working on yourself, your ego, is pretty much how you deal with those people, which is very, God knows it is harder than hell, especially for an asshole like me. I had some very tough ones, and I was fortunate to get to learn from them as students. I learned a different aspect about life than they learned from me. They learned about flying from me. I learned about life from them and how to work with people from them. God, I hope that gives you something, anything to go off of, but that is something all instructors have to deal with, and it is tough.
Yeah, I wish I could impart just as far as the people aspect of it, all like the dealership customer service stuff I did.
I don't know how much that, because you're stuck with this person. You have to sit right like 2 feet from them and deal with them, just them, for those 40, 50, 60 hours. And you want that to be a relationship that you can cultivate. I mean, and you guys know, like, if you're on pilot ground, get on pilot ground, talk to Jeff. I mean, Jeff was one of my students. I can't remember exactly how early on he was. I didn't know shit. Luckily, these people just signed on and dealt with me. They just dealt with me and the things I didn't know, my lack of immaturity. I was fortunate that I had a group of people. Now I lost some. I didn't learn on until I almost starved that it's a sales role for the most part. You're not in there to beat people up and make them, you know, top gun. You're not there to do that. You're there if it takes them 80 hours. You are there with them, kind of through thick and thin, with all of the stumbling blocks and roadblocks and their life that gets in the way. That's something that I didn't take in. And honestly, this dawned on me last night. I'm reading, and this will come out on Pilot Ground, I think. I'm reading the new Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge. Thanks, Ground Crew. And I'm reading through it, and I'm sitting there in bed last night. We got Spring Baking Championship on the Food Network, and that's what my wife and I like to watch. And so that's on in the background. I'm like, how did somebody, I got the kids sleeping in between us and one of the kids, and how do people, they're 56 years old, they have a company to run, they have their day job, maybe they have two jobs, I don't know, kids are at college, I don't know what they have going on, but they have life happening, and I expected them to devote every fiber of their being into learning to fly and read this damn book. I'm like, I know 90% of the shit that I'm reading right now, and it's a pain in the ass for me to read if I'm going to do it, if I'm going to be invested. So that's one of the things, is everybody has life going on, other impediments. And although you as an instructor don't have to less necessarily harp on them and listen to every reason, every excuse they have why they didn't get all the way through that chapter or why they didn't get the lesson out of that chapter, they had shit going on. They had shit going on. That's as simple as that. And that shit going on for them is now shit going on for you, because it makes you accountable for them learning that material, if that's what it takes. All these things, which sounds so elementary now, and I feel ashamed and embarrassed to even talk about this type of thing, like, candidly, that's something I didn't know or understand at the time.
Develop some sales skills, I think, to be a good CFI.
100%.
Obviously, to get and keep the clients, but also just to, like, in a lot of situations, you have to sell the reasons why someone needs to know an aspect when they cannot yet see the reason why.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
100%.
That's more so where I think a lot of the skill comes in, is not everyone's going to. Yeah, sure, you have some students that are going to come in and they just want to know it all. You know, they're type A's, they're OCD.
Yeah.
You know, they're at a point in their life where they got time to read it up. You know, like when I went through scuba diving stuff, like, I just got really into it when I was going through the courses. And most people aren't,